attorney, advocate, author, public speaker. The Lisa Wexler Show. WICC 600. Flip that switch and turn on your brain. Here is Lisa Wexler.
At 6 minutes after the hour, welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show, 203-333-9422. We'll turn a little bit later to what's happening on Capitol Hill. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman continuing to testify now before Republican counsel Steve Castor. But before we get to that, we've got a very special guest in the studio, and I wanted to give our guest a chance to share some very important things that are happening that may affect you or a loved one, because if we look at the statistics, the real problems affecting Americans are drug abuse. The incidence of people dying as a result of overdoses are greater than car accidents. We're at an astounding rate. Every single year it seems to be growing. Maybe we've capped it and we're on the wane. But between fentanyl, methamphetamine, opiate, now the push for marijuana recreationally, which some argue is a gateway drug for other kinds of uses of other substances, we are truly living in epidemic times. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that our biggest problem in America right now are the astounding thousands and thousands of people who are seeking other substances to numb their feelings, numb their emotions, get high, whatever you want to call it, or who have been made victims of addiction because they originally had accidents and they were prescribed medicines and something in their brain clicked and they simply couldn't stop the cravings for getting more. And our next guest, Walter Ginter, knows an awful lot about this from his personal history, as well as the professional life he has devoted to trying to educate people about an alternative, a very important alternative, medication-assisted alternative to trying to get off drugs. Walter Ginter is the founding project director of the Medication-Assisted Recovery Support. It's known as MARS. The project is designed to provide peer recovery support to persons whose recovery from opiate addiction is assisted by medication. This year, he was appointed to the National Academy of Science Committee on Medications of Opiate Use Disorder, and he was a recipient of the Richard Lane Robert Holden Patient Advocacy Award. He has received the 2012 Vernon Johnson Award. He has been awarded and recognized for many things, and he's been to the White House more than once. He's even traveled to Vietnam and other places on behalf of this country. Walter Ginter, welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hi.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi. So, Walter, you wanted to be here, very important, because you told me that there was important news that we don't know about that is possibly going to affect your world of people who are seeking recovery, addicts who are seeking recovery in order to live a better and more sober life. So tell us, Walter, what is this issue that is preying on your mind? What's going on?
Okay. Let me just introduce myself to the audience. My name is Walter Ginter, and I'm a person in sustained recovery. And my recovery is assisted by medication, specifically methadone. But it could have been any of the other federally approved medications. And the reason I say that, it's because that I've been on methadone more than 40 years now that I have the life I have. I live in a nice house in Westport, and I have a dog and a wife and a great family, and none of that would exist. I'd be dead if it wasn't on medication. That said, the one thing I want people to realize is that addiction is not bad behavior alone. Okay, addiction is a medical condition, and I don't know any family here in Connecticut that doesn't have someone who has been afflicted by or addicted to or dependent upon opiates. Now, the reason I was so frantic about getting on the show today is about something called 42 CFR Part 2.
Well, that's easy to say.
Yeah, that's easy to say. What that really means, that's the CFR means the Code of Federal Regulations. 42 CFR is the federal regulations that for many, many years now have protected people in opiate addiction treatment from their names being revealed to someone. It's confidentiality. It's a very specific confidentiality regulation only for people in addiction treatment.
Okay.
And it's been very, very effective. for, oh, maybe 20 years now, different doctors and people like that have said, oh, it would be much more convenient for us if we didn't have this. And
how would it be more convenient for doctors? Don't they always have to respect patients' confidentiality?
Well, okay. Now, yeah, we have HIPAA. Okay.
Right.
HIPAA is, well, you know, when you go into your doctor's office, they hand you a little sheet there and you sign HIPAA, and it's a blanket release.
Right.
Okay. That means he can talk about your case to anybody from now until
particularly the insurance companies.
Yeah, from now until the end of time.
Okay.
42 CFR is different. Every time the doctor wants to release my records about addiction to someone, I have to sign an individual release. So just because I'm his patient in treatment and I signed a HIPAA waiver, he can't call up the pharmacist and tell him I'm a drug addict or whatever. And this is really, really going to be an issue now because they're trying to change it, and they're probably going to. The Congress is changing it. This is part of a small part of the president's plan to do away with regulations, burdensome regulations.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, we think is wrong. We don't think it's a burdensome regulation. It's protecting people. And what I've already found out is that people are panicking. People currently in treatment are starting to panic. And what we're doing is people in my situation, people who've been in treatment for many, many years, and I know a congressman who's in treatment. I know a lot of doctors. There's a lot of people who you wouldn't suspect are in treatment who are doing very well and living very, very productive lives. But they're panicking.
They're panicking because so it's not about they're not afraid that their own personal physician is going to tell someone. What they're afraid is that without this really strong confidentiality provision, that anybody who can get access to an electronic healthcare system will tell people.
That's correct.
And there are a lot of people that are not doctors that have access to our healthcare system. There are a million administrative aides everywhere.
You said it. And, you know, and part of the problem now is that, well, one thing we're afraid of is, and we're already starting to see it, is people aren't going to go into treatment if they think they're not protective. One of the things that 42 CFR protects against is if you're in an opiate treatment program and the police are looking for you, say, okay? Now, under the current regulations, well, if they know you're going to an opiate treatment program, the judge can sign a warrant and say, go pick up Walter. He's at this treatment program. But they can't just go to an opiate treatment program and hang out with a book looking for people to come by, okay?
Yeah, of course not.
Because most people who have addiction histories have, records for possession of drugs like that. Most people clear it up, but they don't clear it up the first day they go into treatment.
Of course not.
Okay? So what happens is people, if they think that the police are going to be checking them out as they go into a program, they're never going to go into a program. And they don't want. And a lot of times, you know, and the biggest thing is not the police and not the doctors. It's people's families.
Yes.
We really, you know, people don't want their mother-in-law to know that they're in addiction treatment, even if it's been 20 years.
But how would their mother-in-law ever find out?
How does anybody find out? You know, as I was saying, HIPAA is not a very robust regulation, okay? And suppose especially if you're in a small town. Okay, that's what I'm really worried. The pharmacist sees you're a drug addict because he's selling your prescriptions.
Right.
Do you think that's not going to spread everywhere through that town if it's open to his pharmacy assistant? It's on a computer. It's on your electronic health record.
Oh, right now it's not there.
No, it's not there.
So let's talk about that. So we're chatting with Walter Ginter, 203-333-9422. So right now, if you're an addict and you go to medication-assisted program, which means you've decided that you're going to do methadone. Is it methadone or methadone?
Methadone.
Methadone, even though it's O-N-E?
People say it methadone. Both ways.
All right, methadone. Mm-hmm. So if you're going on methadone, right now, nobody knows that unless you want to tell them. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
But if the law is changed the way they're proposing to change it, then what, your local pharmacist could know about it, whereas nowadays he doesn't know about it?
That's correct.
Oh.
Well, not only that, there is something called the prescription database.
Yes.
And one of the things that will happen if we don't have 42 CFR is medications that you're taking for addiction will suddenly become on your prescription database, which people have been...
And they're not on it now.
No, they're
not. So if you're taking Suboxone, or if you're taking... What are the other possibilities that you could be taking?
Vivitrol or methadone or buprenorphine.
Okay, so there are at least four of them. And people know if you're taking them, you're taking them to fight a prior addiction. Right now, that's not on a widely available database at all.
Nope.
But it will be.
Yes, it will.
And that's a problem.
People are afraid. They're people who've been in treatment for many, many years are doing something that we consider horrendous. They're stockpiling medication. They're taking part of their dose and putting part of their dose away so that when this passes, they can leave the program. So
oh,
their
that's
name doesn't
terrible,
go on.
Walter.
What's going to happen is people who've been in treatment and doing very well for years and years are going to relapse.
If you know that and you've got influence, you've been in Washington, D.C. more than once, how can we stop that? I mean, in all of these deregulations, who is best served? What interest is being served by getting rid of this regulation?
Well, insurance companies.
Oh, there it is.
Okay.
Are they lobbying to get rid of this regulation?
Yes, very strongly.
And there it is.
Well, also, you know, one of the arguments that I've heard the doctors use is that, well, if we don't know that you're taking an addiction medication, suppose you come into an emergency room.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, that's fine. Now, do you know how many people have died because they went to an emergency room and the doctors didn't know they were on medication in the 50 years we've had methadone treatment? None.
Okay.
It's a bogus.
It's a bogus.
Yeah. And the fact
it's far more likely that people who are using won't tell. Not that people that are on medication-assisted and are in a sobriety program won't tell. Those people will tell. It's the people who are still using that won't tell.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, we don't have a tremendous amount of data on it, but the two studies I've read show that when people who are on medications, specifically methadone, tell a doctor or someone in the emergency room or anybody when they're looking for medical care, the quality of care they get, it goes from positive to pretty much zero. There's only been two studies. I'd like to see more done. But both studies reveal the same thing. People who reveal they're in addiction treatment and taking a medication do not get good primary medical care. Doctors think, no matter what reason you're there, you're trying to make them for a prescription. And the funny thing is, people who are on medication for addiction are the last people in the world who are going to take opiates. We're blockaded.
That's right. That's what it does.
Yes.
203-333-9422. We're chatting with Walter Ginter. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes after 11. 203-333-9422. Walter Ginter is with us in the studio, and he's talking about the panic that seems to be spreading among people who are in addiction treatment, who have been so for many, many years. Walter, you say how long for you? 40 years?
Well, actually more than that, but I admit to 40.
You admit to 40 was the one that stuck?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And if you're in medication-assisted treatment, does that mean that you have to check in with somebody every day? What does that look like for you?
For me, I'm on something called medical maintenance. I see a private physician who's an addiction specialist once a month.
Okay.
And I go in, like everybody else, I give him a check and I get my medication.
You get your money.
Yeah.
I mean, you get your medicine. And this bypasses insurance?
Well, no, I can, if I want, I could submit my bills to insurance, but...
But you don't want to.
I don't want to.
You don't want to. Because once you voluntarily submit for insurance, then you're obviously disclosing your condition. So is what I'm hearing, Walter, that many people who are in addiction treatment and who use medicine in order to stay well and function pay for it privately? They bypass their own normal medical insurance?
Yes. Most people will not. That's not 100% true. People on buprenorphine, which is considered a less...
Stigmatized
medication. Yes,
yes.
Might submit it to their insurance company. People who are on Medicaid, Medicaid covers it now. Covers medication for addiction treatment.
Should
and pretty much all the Medicaid expansion states have it now, which was a problem for a while. But people who are paying on their own, and most patients across the country aren't. They pay on an average of $19 a day,
really,
just for methadone treatment, Think about
that
it. You and your wife are both in treatment, and you're paying $19 a day. That's a house payment.
Yeah. Are there many couples that are still together that are both in addiction treatment?
Yeah.
There are.
Oh, sure. And most of them, it's what kept their marriage together, you know, going into treatment together.
Okay.
But, you know, the one thing, I want people to realize that, you know, they can help us. You know, they can contact their congressman. This is a federal regulation, but, you know, calls to the congressman saying this shouldn't be.
Congressman Himes.
Right.
Or possibly, certainly Senator Murphy, Senator mm-hmm. Blumenthal. Yes, Congresswoman yeah. Hayes. I'm trying to think of the ones that are around our specific listening area, but you usually know who your congressman is.
Yes, contact them. I mean, even if you don't talk to them directly, they all
and
have
this is not a state issue. This is a federal issue.
They all have a health aide in the local offices.
Okay.
And you could talk to them.
That's who you should speak
That's
to.
That's who you should speak to, yeah.
Someone in charge of health care policy at your congressman's office.
Right.
Okay. And then you should say to them, listen, I object because the last thing we want to do is discourage people from going into addiction recovery treatment.
You know, that's true. And you know who we're seeing going into treatment now is not people like me who are, you know, old and been in treatment for 100 years, but young people, people who got a sports injury or whatever, and they started using medication. And their parents probably don't even know about it. They're 16 or 17 years old. And suddenly they find out that their child is addicted. Well, you know, that child is probably not going to be on medication for the rest of their life like I am, okay?
Okay.
But it will help them to be on medication for maybe a year or two, well, you know, especially while they work out their problems,
sure.
while they work out their issues, and I don't want to take that out of the realm of possibilities, because addiction isn't going to get better on its own; it's just going to get worse. Okay, and as I said, am I advocating that everybody should be on medication? Of course not. If you can go into a therapeutic community or a detox and be weaned off of narcotics, and then and you're fine.
But what are the statistics of people who actually do that?
Well, they're terrible.
It's like 7% or less,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's terrible.
It means like well over 93% of people who spend $45,000 for 45 days in one of these treatment programs are going to go back and use.
Yeah, and most of them go in many times. You know,
many times.
Yeah. You know, people want to stop.
Of course they do.
And they go there. They get good treatment. And when they release them, what do they tell them? They, you know, go to meetings. Well, which meetings are great. But some people need more support than that.
So let's just talk a little bit about the medication. What does the medication do that helps someone when they have the will, but there's that other insistent part of the brain, that very strong craving of the brain that keeps them wanting the craving of that original substance? What is the medicine doing for you?
Okay. What it does is the craving is actually biological, okay, in the sense that we all have opiate receptors in our body. And when we start using illicit drugs or even pharmaceutical medications not correctly, it causes damage to those receptors. What the medication does, it bonds to the receptors in such a way that you will not crave any illicit opiates anymore. Buprenorphine bonds to receptors so tightly that you can't even take pain medication and feel it. Methadone bonds.
So what happens when you're in pain?
Well, then what happens when you're in pain is you have to either take a non-narcotic pain or
like an Aleve or Advil or something like that.
Which a lot of people do.
Okay.
And some people, I mean, there are cases. I know people had to go in for surgery and things like that. And what happens if they taper off of buprenorphine and they move them back over to methadone for a while until they...
Okay. So that's what they do. There are ways to get around it if you
yes.
know you're going to be in pain.
Yeah.
Okay. But so they block the receptor that would make you enjoy opium, and they block an opiate, and they block the receptor that would make you crave opiates?
That's correct. And so, you know, as long as you're on an adequate dose, and one of the problems we've had over the course of time is when people go into treatment, they all want to be on the smallest possible dose.
Yeah.
I want to, you know, and
they wanted the most possible of the drug that they like, but they want to be on the smallest possible dose of the drug to get better.
And even in a place where I
don't am, you love it? I know a lot of drug addicts who are like, I don't do meds. I'm a natural person. But you know, in their private secret life, they're not that person at all.
Yeah, well.
We all live with a lot of contradictions.
Yeah. You know, I have people in and even in my project, a recovery project, where people know better and we train them, they'll still, one of them will brag, well, I'm only on 20 milligrams.
Yeah, like that's a bragging,
like,
right?
That's better than someone who was on 60
yeah,
milligrams.
Yeah, makes no sense.
Absolutely.
Who cares? All right, so Walter, how can people find you? I know your message today is that you're very concerned that confidentiality is being eroded, that there's a proposal to turn back a regulation that has kept addiction treatment programs and people who are taking medicine to assist them in getting over these opiates, that's been kept strictly confidential, and there's a proposal to overturn that, which will allow a lot more people to look at it, and it's panicking people within the addiction community. So, number one, you want people to call their congressman. That's the number one call to action. But how can people find you if they have questions about medication-assisted recovery?
Well, they could tweet me at Walter at Mars Recovery. They could email me. The best email address to reach me would be marsdirector@yahoo.com.
Mars, M-A-R-S, like the planet.
Yeah,
director. marsdirector@yahoo.com.
And they could, I work currently at the Montefiore Medical Center, so they could call me there. And the number for my office would be 718-742-7804.
Okay. Thank you, Walter.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks.
The Lisa Wexler Show. We'll have more coming up on WICC 600. Stick around. And welcome back. It's 1131 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422. The impeachment hearings will be resuming shortly, and as they do, we'll go back and forth at 203-333-9422 so we can go back to politics. I think we've already got some people on the queue, and we'll take your calls right here. 203-333-9422 is our number for people who want to talk impeachment. Of course, the question on the table is, did the president do anything wrong? And if he did, is what he did significant, a high crime and misdemeanor enough in your view? And that term, by the way, is constitutional, but it is purposely not specifically defined. It is in the know it when I'll see it, much like obscenity. Justice Lewis Powell, our constitutional justice, said many years ago when it came to obscenity, he said, I know it when I see it. Do you know a high crime and misdemeanor when you see it? Peter from Wallingford. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show today. Hello. Hi, Peter. Welcome back. Hello. Peter, you there?
I am here. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi, Peter.
Lisa, I think, I have no clairvoyant powers, but I think that at the Democratic convention next summer, we're looking at a contested convention because they have a group of candidates that lacks a thoroughbred, and I don't see any one of them emerging with enough victories in these primaries before the convention to have it locked up or to have a commanding lead. I think they're going to be fighting among themselves, and they may need a compromise candidate. It could be somebody who has a lesser profile, but I don't know. What do you think?
I think what we know from history is that Iowa gives candidates a boom, but the person who emerges in Iowa is rarely the actual candidate. If you look historically, the person who emerges from New Hampshire has a lot better shot. And usually, after Iowa and New Hampshire, a lot of people can't get funding anymore, Peter, and their campaigns fold, and they start trying to vie to be vice president. It's going to be interesting to see if Michael Bloomberg has any impact. I personally think he's made some strategic missteps in the last couple of days, apologizing for stop and frisk and all this other stuff while the New York Times pats him on the back. You know what? You were mayor for 12 years. Own it. Just own it. Don't go back over it. Just say, I did the best job I could with what I had at the time. Crime rates were lower even than under Giuliani. I presided over tremendous safety and tremendous innovation in New York City, and I stand by my record and leave it alone. I can't stand when people trip over themselves like this today, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to appease a segment of the Democratic Party that is never going to like them. I mean, what makes Donald Trump think that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is ever going to go away from Bernie Sanders and go to Michael Bloomberg? It ain't going to happen. So to the extent that he goes on and prostrates himself before the very left, he's missing the boat. If he's going to be a candidate at all, he has to go right to the center of America, not to the left.
You are correct. I hear a lot of emotion in your voice there, so your feelings are very strong. But he has no chance. I'm looking at Amy Klobuchar, but she can't emerge, and she's got to. She would be perfect, I think, because she's center left. She isn't taking any of these crazy positions on Medicare for all,
right?
Which I think is a losing proposition. She seems reasonable. You know, that
She is reasonable. And not only that, apparently she's got a great sense of humor on the trail. The New York Times wrote a whole piece about how in her private small gatherings, she shows a surprising sense of humor that obviously we can't see on a national stage. And so I just thought that was a really interesting side, you know, personal profile on her. It's very hard to break through. Look, it's Warren, it's Biden, it's Sanders, and it's Buttigieg. Those are the big four right now.
The first three are not going to be able to make it. Buttigieg is very interesting. Did you see USA Today, the cover story on the front?
No, I didn't read it. What did it say?
He apparently is ahead in Iowa, but that raises the question, which is tough. Would the country consider a gay American to be president of the United States? Would they vote for him? I don't know.
I don't know why they vote against him. I mean, the guy was military, you know,
absolutely.
Patriot. He was a McKinsey consultant, which is the cream of the crop. He's a Midwestern guy. He is also resisting calls to be very liberal about certain social policies, you know, certain
Correct.
Medicare.
Correct.
I just think he's too young. You know, he just appears so young.
You think young. The age factor
yes.
will disqualify him?
Not disqualify him. I think he could be the VP. I think he could be the VP.
Very interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
But I think they're looking at a contested convention, and I think they're going to be arguing among themselves, and there will be some deal, and maybe somebody else will emerge. We don't know. Maybe somebody we're not even talking about. You know, Andrew Yang is very impressive when he talks. He seems to be a very sharp guy.
He is a sharp guy. I agree with
he
you.
He is, yeah.
He is a sharp guy.
But, I mean, they can't go down the tubes with Bernie or Elizabeth Warren.
It's happened before. People have shot themselves in the foot many times, Peter.
I know. I know that.
Peter, what do you think about the impeachment hearings?
I think they should go on, and I want to hear who is the one who gave the $1 million to get his ambassadorship. He's speaking later
Sonderland,
this week.
Gordon Sonderland, yes.
We want to hear what he says. I think he's going to have to tell the truth, even though he's supposedly a Trump guy, but I don't think they want to perjure themselves. I think it should go on so that we learn the facts. But with a lot of the hardcore Trump supporters, they just don't care about any of his indiscretions. Somebody called earlier today and was talking about his disrespect for women.
Yes. I thought it was a very moving call, actually. Very passionate call.
I heard that. But listen, after the Access Hollywood tape, they simply don't care. So, the truest thing he said was that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose any votes. And that's absolutely correct. His hardcore supporters have surrendered. They bow to him. Rational thought is gone. All he has to do is repeat the same thing over and over. It doesn't have to be true. If they hear it enough, they assume it's true. So he's just going to have to be beaten, but the Democrats need a solid candidate right now on the horizon. I don't see any, so we'll see what happens.
Thanks for the call, Peter.
Thank you, Lisa. Be good now. Bye-bye.
203-333-9422. We have Adam Schiff presiding again at these House Intelligence Committee hearings, asking questions both of Jennifer Williams and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. We're just going to go to it for a little bit.
Lateral meeting was a large meeting that involved two or three dozen people, wasn't it?
It was.
So in the context of this meeting with two or three dozen people, the vice president didn't bring up those investigations,
so
correct?
So I'm going to get out of here in
No,
about
he did not bring
minutes.
Up those investigations. He's never brought up those investigations.
Were you aware that immediately, and I mean immediately, after that meeting broke up, Ambassador Sondland has said that he went over to Mr. Yermak, one of the top advisors to Zelensky, Yermak, that if they wanted the military aid, they were going to have to do these investigations or words to that effect?
I was not aware at the time of any meetings, side meetings that Ambassador Sondland had following the vice president's meeting with President Zelensky. I've only learned that through Ambassador Sondland's testimony.
So at the big public meeting, it didn't come up, and you can't speak to the private meeting that was held immediately thereafter?
Correct. The vice president moved on with his schedule immediately after his meeting with President Zelensky.
Now, Colonel Vindman, I want to go back to that July 10th meeting or meetings, the one with Ambassador Bolton and then the one in the wardroom that followed quickly on its heels. Were you aware that Ambassador Bolton instructed your superior, Dr. Hill, to go talk to the lawyers after that meeting?
I learned shortly after she was finished talking to Ambassador Bolton and after we wrapped up with the wardroom that she did have a meeting with him, and that's what was expressed.
Now, you thought you should go talk to the lawyers on your own, correct?
That is my recollection, yes.
But Bolton also thought that Dr. Hill should go talk to the lawyers because of his concern over this drug deal that Sondland and Mulvaney were cooking up. Is that right?
That is my understanding.
And in fact, this drug deal, as Bolton called it, involved this conditioning of the White House meeting on these investigations that Sondland brought up. Is that right?
That is my understanding.
And in fact, this same conditioning or the same issue of wanting these political investigations and tying it to the White House meeting, this came up in the July 25th call, did it not, when the president asked for these investigations?
That is correct.
So the very same issue that Bolton said to Hill, go talk to the lawyers, the very same issue that prompted you to go talk to the lawyers, ends up coming up in that call with the president. Is that right?
That is correct.
And it was that conversation that once again led you back to the lawyer's office.
That is correct.
Now I yield to the ranking member.
That's a little bit more of what's going on right now today. And the Republicans are now going to be going back and forth. You just heard a little bit of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who is answering questions in front of the congressional impeachment inquiry that goes on today. And those questions began at 10 a.m. this morning, and they'll continue throughout the morning and as well as tomorrow and the next day. 203-333-9422 at 1143. A couple more subjects we really didn't cover that much today about, but Connecticut is taking a very strong stance against domestic violence, and the Violence Against Women Act is up for renewal. We have a Connecticut mother who actually testified in Washington, D.C. on behalf of renewing the Violence Against Women Act. Unfortunately, we do way too little despite the laws on our books. I think it's pretty clear that the laws need to be strengthened when it comes to guns. And as far as I'm concerned, if somebody has been demonstrably shown to be guilty of any domestic violence within their own home, I don't understand why that person would ever be entitled to keep or obtain a gun. And I'll just say that. Because the incidence of women, and they usually are women, getting killed by formerly romantic partners are astounding. And every single day we're reporting to you on the missing Jennifer Dulos case. And that is very definitely being investigated as a criminal case by the police. And it is the signs point to violence as a result of a relationship that was the most domestic of all. in the sense that her husband is the person under inquiry. Almost every case that we read of, that we see of a suspected young woman who was then found murdered, can be traced to a former boyfriend. Almost every single one. The incidents of stranger death are far more rare than those of being killed by somebody you knew that purported at one time to love you. So we call it domestic violence, but it's really family violence. There's nothing domestic, there's nothing calm, there's nothing sweet about it. There's nothing serene about it. And to the extent we're even debating whether or not we need a re-upping of the Violence Against Women Act, I think the statistics bear out that we most likely do. It's 11:45. I'm Lisa Wexler. Stay tuned for more news you may have missed here on The Lisa Wexler Show at WICC 600. Tomorrow, in case I forget to tell you, we have a really extraordinary guest coming in the studio. We have Anna Rae Mundy. Anna Rae Mundy is a medium. And every now and then, I do like to have mediums come in because it is my personal belief that there are people who understand how to reach the other side and that people derive a lot of comfort in hearing from those that are on the other side. Anna Rae Mundy came into my studio not long ago, and she blew me away. First of all, she read me, which meant that she knew about the people that had passed that were still around me, and she identified them by name and different specific details, which nobody really could know. And she might read you tomorrow if you're one of the callers who calls in. She's pretty unbelievable, so it's sort of exciting. It's not political, it's not current events, but it's a little bit of fun on The Lisa Wexler Show. Stay tuned. And welcome back to the show. I want to talk about a little bit of news you may have missed today. The Lisa Wexler Show here on WICC 600. First of all, in big news you may have missed, did you know that you could listen to this show on 99.1? If you've got HD radio, if you've got the HD radio, which is in many cars, if the cars are newer than 2017, you might not even know about it. If you've got HD radio, you can go on HD2. And at 99.1, you will actually hear yours truly, the voice of WICC. So that's a pretty cool thing to do if you're in the car right now and you want to experiment with that. Or maybe you're at home and you have an HD radio. Go on 99.1 and then you press the HD2 button and WICC 600 comes right out. The other thing I want to let you know is every single day, Christian does such a marvelous job of taking our show, hours one and hours two, and he also summarizes them and lets you know the guest. And if you go on WICC600.com or on a site called SoundCloud.com, that's one word, you can actually download our show as a podcast so you can listen to it at your leisure whenever you want. And it won't even have any commercials. So anyway, this is the Lisa Wexler Show. I want to talk a little bit about some news you may have missed. You know, Roger Stone grew up here in Connecticut in Norwalk, and he is certainly one of the president's men, not officially in President Trump's cabinet, but one of his closest supporters and somebody who used to brag about being a dirty tricks guy for Richard Nixon. He's somebody who knows how to play politics very well and prided himself on his steadfast loyalty to President Trump. Well, you may have missed this news, but he was actually convicted last week by a jury in New York. And he was convicted in federal court of obstructing the congressional inquiry. He was convicted of lying to investigators under oath and trying to block the testimony of a witness whose account would have exposed his own lies. He actually could serve a maximum of as much as 50 years. But Roger Stone has had no previous criminal record, so likely he will have a much lighter sentence than that. He is also possibly going to seek a presidential pardon. He is returned after his conviction. He's 67 years old. He arrived at Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport on Sunday afternoon. And when asked about it, said, "I can't comment any further than what I have just said. I'm sorry." But he was convicted in federal court of 7 felonies. Jurors deliberated for a little over 7 hours before convicting him on all counts. And in a last minute bid for salvation, Roger Stone appealed to President Trump for a pardon on Thursday. He used a right-wing conspiracy theorist who runs a website, InfoWars, we know him as Alex Jones, as his proxy. In other words, he asked Alex to ask for the pardon. Mr. Trump attacked the guilty verdict against Mr. Stone in a tweet on Friday, but thus far has made no mention of a pardon. And Judge Amy Berman Jackson will sentence Roger Stone on February 6th. In other news you may have missed, Coty, you know Coty, the cosmetics company? They bought 51% of Kylie Jenner's makeup business for $600 million. Okay, who's laughing to the bank now? It's easy for us to say, oh, we would never watch the Kardashian people. The Kardashian, what are they called? Keep Up with the Kardashians? And I personally pride myself on never having watched the show. But they're laughing to the bank. I'm not laughing to the bank. They're on their way laughing to the bank. Coty bought 51% of Kylie Jenner's makeup business for $600 million. She's only 22 years old. In 2015, she started with lip liner and lipstick. Forbes called her the youngest self-made billionaire on the 2018 list. And in 2018, she had sales of $360 million. Coty valued the business at $1.2 billion. So the bottom line is she walked away with a lot of money, but she no longer controls her own business. And maybe she doesn't care. She's 22. She's got the rest of her life to live. Maybe she doesn't want to be in charge of such an extraordinary business that took off like crazy. You're listening to the Lisa Wexler Show here on WICC 600. Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve met with President Trump yesterday for the first time since February. Wouldn't you like to be a fly on that wall? In the past, President Trump has questioned whether Powell or Chinese President Xi Jinping was a bigger enemy of America. He's like, well, which is a bigger enemy of America? Is it the head of the Federal Reserve, who I chose, you, Mr. Jerome Powell, or is it the president of China? He actually called Federal Reserve officials boneheads. And so we really don't know what the upshot of that meeting was. In other news you may have missed, GPS is modernizing flight paths. And this is causing tremendous concern about noise in neighborhoods and intrusion. NextGen is using GPS instead of radar for fuel efficiency. And what that means is there will be more flights because they will be more efficiently routed, but they are going to fly at lower altitudes. For example, in Phoenix, in 2014, there were 25 noise complaints about the Phoenix Sky Airport. But when flight paths were altered in 2014, the number jumped to 2,500. And in 2015, the last year for which they could find records of this, 12,000 complaints were lodged on the basis of noise. So what does that mean for us? Well, those of us who live in the shadow, perhaps, of Bradley or the shadow of Westchester Airport, we have to be very mindful of this because this is a new way that the FAA is figuring out how to direct flights. And as those altitudes get lower, the planes are obviously going to get noisier. And so in order to do anything about this, you basically have to be speaking to your congressman, because altering flight paths is no easy task. I saw this story today on Tuesdays in the New York Times. They do a Science Times feature. And I thought this was really cool to let you know. So apparently in California, did you know this is so sad, actually? 95% of all wild salmon have disappeared. 95%. That's unbelievable. They call them salmonids. They're like the baby salmons. And one of their natural predators are these wild terns, these tiny little, beautiful little birds. And because the terns' habitat was also displaced, and of course a lot of this is due to human beings, right? What else? So we displaced the habitat of the terns, and we moved them to a place where they fed on the baby salmons, and they, along with a lot of other causes, helped extinguish the salmon population. So in California, they came up with this, but the terns are also an endangered species. So they're a protected species, and the salmon are a protected species, but the terns are feeding on the salmon, and by the time we're done, we're not going to have terns or salmon. So you know what the people in California did? This is really interesting and cool. They made these plastic tern decoys, and they created pairs of what look to be, they're fake birds, I'm not kidding you, fake terns that were put on beaches to attract the real terns, T-E-R-N-S, these birds, who would then feed not on salmon, but on sardines and on other species that are not endangered. And they figured if they put enough plastic decoys in a different feeding place, that they would lure this protected species of tern to move so that instead of eating the few salmon that are left, they would now eat the sardines, and therefore the tern would do better as a species, and the salmon would do better as a species. This is in the front page of today's science section of the New York Times. I love it. I never miss it. It's always on Tuesdays. And apparently, and this is the cool thing, it seems to be working. It seems to be working. These ingenious scientists who are trying to save two species at once are using plastic birds to protect endangered fish. And the story comes out of the San Francisco Bay National Wildlife Refuge in California. So if you happen to be kayaking along there, you might think that you're seeing real birds, when in fact you may be seeing plastic decoys. It's a cool story. We're catching up a little bit. Welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show here on WICC 600. If you're just joining us now, we're doing some news you may have missed. And in and around from around the country, let me give you some headlines. A man has pled guilty to threatening to kill Representative Ilhan Omar from New York. Patrick Carlinea admitted in Rochester to charges that carry up to 10 years in prison. He is sentenced. His sentencing is set for, I can say that five times without stopping, for February 14th. The state of California has sued Juul, e-cigarette maker Juul Labs. They are alleging that Juul Labs engaged in a systematic and wildly successful campaign to attract teenagers to its nicotine devices. And yesterday, we know that President Trump reversed course, that he was apparently going to be all set to trying to clamp down on these flavored e-cigarettes, but decided not to because he was afraid that he would endanger some of his support. And by support, I'm probably talking about big business. This is the Lisa Wexler Show, and we've been catching up on some news you may have missed.